Blog Talk Radio.
All right, we're back. We're back, you guys. So let me open both your mics now to be sure. And they're coming. All right, I got both you guys on the line now. Wayne, you wanted to briefly finish your point, then Byron, we'll go to you so you can jump in here and talk about and give us the first-hand account since you're on the front line, okay, at least in D.C.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, I was gonna, just to chime in and conclude my comments, basically, it just goes to show that you may be of color and be a member of the force and might have been appointed to show diversity, but the underlying problem with the police department coast to coast is the culture of the department, not just who they hire, and pressure. As I made a reference this a couple of weeks ago with Soledad O'Brien's piece, the documentary about New York City policemen having to meet a quota. I mean, and it involved men of color in the department, men and women of color in the department having to reach a quota. You have all sorts of pressures that are involved. So, therefore, unless you change the culture of the department, and I know there's some of our young folks who are espousing a disbandment of the police period, which is an interesting concept, but we'll save that for another time. But, that's basically it. I'm just taken back by what I've seen and witnessed.
Yeah, well, they all have quotas, so I don't think that's as much pressure on the black and brown as much, because the white ones have quotas, too. Obviously, the black and browns are caught in the trick bag because they got to enforce it on their people. But, yeah, the whole disbanding is an interesting thing. But I want to get you in here, Byron, because you're down there in D.C., right there where the guy committed all those offensive acts.
Well, yes, I'm in the cesspool, and we have been in the third day of a lockdown. Tonight, the lockdown, we get an amber alert from the mayor who tells us that we are in lockdown from tonight is 11 p.m. to 6 a.m.
So how does that come? Does that come like on a text?
Yeah, it comes on a text. Your phone is like, bah, bah, there it is, being notified by the mayor. And so you appreciate it because if you're out there in the street, you don't want to be beyond the time to be inside, although they've been very relaxed with arresting. But yes, I'm furious. I live in the nation's capital, and the world is watching us. And our democracy took a frontline fascist hit the other day when that clown in the office went down there for a photo op, throwing flash bombs and tear gassing people who were demonstrating civilly. That's as a provocateur himself, engaging to incite. And at the same time, today, June the 3rd, 2020, we have over 108,220 people dead from the pandemic. There are 1,880,261 who are infected, and the counting is continuing. It's going forward. There are over 47 million people unemployed. In Washington, D.C., your nation's capital, there are 473 people have died from the virus. 9,016 are infected. That's not counting Virginia and Maryland. That's counting just Washington, D.C. And in New York City, your financial capital of the world, you got, as of today, there are 20,895 people dead in New York City. Not the state, the city. Out of 8.5 million people today, over 205,854 people are infected, and the counting continues. Now, people, we've been invaded. You can call it what it is, but we have people dead in our capitals. financial capital and your nation's capital. And then you have that clown stage a photo op in which he militarily violates the Constitution. And let's be very clear. The people who are responsible for allowing him to do that are Lindsey Graham, William Barr, Mitch McConnell, and Michael Pence, their vice president. And let's be very clear, see how history repeats itself. Guess, gentlemen, guess who was in charge of the prosecuting team federally for the Rodney King case? Oh, yeah. This name used kind of familiar, William Barr. That's right. Your current
attorney
general.
He was just
general.
Starting out.
That's right. So make no mistake about it. The method for which is being used right now was and has been used before, and it was used against black people. Now, you add that to the profiling, the racist profiling that's going on, the killings of black men and women and children, and then you have a virus that percentage-wise is killing more African Americans than white people. Now, you tell me why I should be sitting idly by and not be pissed to the highest point of pissativity as an African American, because it seems to me the target is on us, and you're doing nothing, absolutely nothing, to save the lives of my people. No policy, no virus protection. You can't even get a good test, because you got to wait in line behind everybody else. That's treason, people.
That goes back to me saying, like before, it's planned, right? And I said earlier
exactly.
that they're trying to return to the Confederacy, but I think that's what they're doing. The entire Republican Party is complicit in what Donald Trump is doing, this power grab that even General Mathis wrote an article about, and Esper, and these people go along with it. I mean, Esper claimed he didn't know anything about it, and then got on TV and said those weren't. And this is the crazy thing about it. You know, there's a line in a play, one black play, but I'm sure it's just an old black saying that what some white people want us to, or what people tell you, is like, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? And there's footage of cops throwing flashbang grenades. There's footage of them doing tear gas. And so for them to say there's no tear gas, and then there's reports saying that the chemical makeup of whatever compound that you shot at people is consistent with tear gas. So the fact that this man, who's Secretary of the Defense, is going to lie to people when you know there's cameras around. I mean, we can see what you guys are doing, and that's the biggest threat to it, and that's what makes them the most dangerous, because they're doing it right in front of us. They're letting us see exactly what they're doing. The clown, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, marching around in his uniform and on civilian territory or whatever. They were saying that was silly for that guy to come out with this thing. I mean, it was just, you know, it's indicative of what they're trying to do, you know, and that's take over. I mean, it's like I've been saying, you guys remember I've been saying since the beginning, it's like a race. And if he can get enough people down with his conspiracy, put enough people in place before we can get him out of here, they're going to try to pull it off. And we know that they're going to try to steal the election. They're not going to go along with the results of the election. That should be obvious to any thinking American. The fact that they fabricated this opportunity for this guy to come over there. And then you have, what's-her-face, the press agent, Kelly Cockamamie, or whatever her name is. Cockamamie sounds close enough for me. And she made a statement and compared his that photo. It was an iconic moment to Churchill and George Bush. And this is the madness, and this is the lies, the complete fabrication of stuff, just making stuff up. Said it was iconic. And just without any regard, or maybe they do, was clearly just a disregard to actual facts and history, and it's white supremacy, just making it up, make up the myth of how great we are. I mean, for you to say that this guy walking across the street, taking a picture in front of in the middle of a protest, of a riot, because a citizen was murdered on camera with his life snuffed out, and this thing, this photo op, was one of those iconic moments in history. She might as well admit that she's a white supremacist. That's like saying this is a – I mean, because the reason that it was done, the reason that the occasion came about was because of this tragedy, this racial tragedy. And this broad is comparing it with an iconic moment in history. Well, I guess she means an iconic moment in racist Confederate history, in white supremacist history. That everything they do indicates – every. I mean, points to their intents. The Republicans are racist. They've allowed a racist to take over and head their party. And they're trying to, you know, this is their attempt to throw things back to you know, white people controlling the country completely and totally in a white supremacist fashion. And there's no mistaking these actions, because this guy is a liar, and everybody all over the world sees it. You know, that's the biggest thing. And then when they were trying to interview the Republicans the other day, we saw that, right? You guys saw that, how the guys just put their heads down
running.
And just walked by.
They're hiding.
You can't even
cowards.
Look people in the eye. That's when someone knows
right.
what they did. You can't even look people in the eye. They wouldn't even lift their heads up. It's like,
that's
wow.
Right.
Literally turning
that's
away from
right.
the camera not to for their face not to be seen.
Right.
You know, I was surprised Romney was questioning
and he didn't respond. Well, yeah, that's the visual that the rest of the world and the entire country is the denial that the GOP and the president is. I'm happy that he's moving the convention out of North Carolina, because he just reduced the effectiveness of having it in the place where money would have been made. Because you got to remember, Charlotte is the capital of the NASCAR headquarters. Okay? Now, you take that money out of that state, you just slap the GOP of the entire state of North Carolina, because they were depending on those funds. And I can tell you, move your GOP convention. I hope it's a game of musical chairs, so that we ultimately, the last place you can have your convention, Mr. President, is on a cruise ship, preferably on your own personal yacht and a slow boat to China. Oh, by the way, stop off in Moscow while you're going. Okay.
You should have it at Mar-a-Lago.
There it is.
I was just going to say, I thought that would be the prevailing thought amongst the pundits down there who are trying to counteract what's going on, because clearly their agenda is not about the safety of even their own constituents. He just wants reality TV crowd that he once had, and he doesn't give a damn at what price it comes. I applaud all these protesters who've risked their lives, but sometimes it's like what Malcolm said, some must die so others will live. It's unfortunate that it comes down to that, but the bottom line is that at least with this situation, there's some legitimacy as to why. You could connect the dots. We're frustrated and we want a change, and it's about time. Maybe, to me, this even surpasses anything that we did in the 60s. These young folks are not standing for this nonsense anymore. But when I saw what was going on in D.C. and when you hear some of the blowback from Fox News, you can almost tell what his thoughts will be the next day, because people like Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity were on the air talking about, you're going to have to do something to stop these, and I'm certain they wanted to say, the N-word from getting out of hand. What are you going to do, Mr. President? We have to do something. You have to show your force. And then he comes up with this theatrical piece in front of an Episcopal church, and from what I understand, the Bible was upside down when he stood for that photo op. And if I'm not mistaken, I also read that one of his daughters, Tiffany, was among those out there protesting. So not all the Trumps have been caught up in the Kool-Aid that the grandfather left behind or what have you. You know, I'd like to think that some,
really
you know,
caring about any
come
to not really
senses.
Caring, not really caring about any of the Trumps and what they're doing, bro, even if
no,
they're
no,
doing positive things.
No, but I'm just saying.
I'm not
you know,
really
we have
interested
to put up
in
with
giving
this
them
crap.
any positive equal time. I mean, I feel you making a
no,
point,
no,
but
it's not even about equal
you
time.
Know.
I mean, it's not even about equal time, Eric.
It's,
you
it's
know,
like,
I have been very, you know, skewered in my thinking and my comments about this man from the very beginning. He has
Absolutely,
to go
yeah.
by any cost, you know? And we cannot look and analyze, you know, what's the thinking of some blacks about Biden. This man's got to freaking go, period. End of story.
Oh, without a doubt.
And the only
without
way that's
going
to happen, the only way
Let
that's
me...
going to happen is to have a landslide victory. And I wish somebody could blow up the Electoral College because I really feel that's the problem. You know,
well, wait, let me
worked
ask you.
With the Democrats.
Let me ask you, Wayne. While we're on the subject of Fox, and I was thinking about this earlier, and the whole advent of the talk radio, particularly conservative talk radio, as an avenue to really galvanize the Republican Party and obviously the more extreme factions of the Republican Party, really started. Back in those days when you and my mom and so many others were working in radio, right, WLIB, because, you know, she would talk about Bob Grant and all that. But that's when, and I guess they always had it, but it seemed to really kind of pick up some sort of momentum, what? If I'm not mistaken. I mean, I want you to comment on that because you were there and lived it. So what's your assessment
yeah.
along those lines? How have things developed eventually into a Fox network and to where it is now? As vis-a-vis
well,
conservative talk.
I happen to agree with you. I mean, the deal is that, I mean, unfortunately, because LIB now is a gospel station, it's lost some of its luster and history as to what we put together. And I intend, before I close my eyes one day, to have this thing documented since some of my former colleagues, you know, were all going one by one. But the bottom line is that back in the day when you had conservative talk show hosts, there was a balance. We just recently lost Barry Farber, who was considered somebody conservative, but at least he had, you know, he allowed the other point of view. You may not agree with all that he had to say because, you know, he was one of those privileged Southern boys that, you know, acted and thought a certain way. But, you know, all of a sudden, I would have to say the success of reporter advocacy, and I don't mean to blow our horn because it wasn't just me single-handedly, but what we did in the late 1970s and early 80s on WLIB and to a lesser extent BLS basically captivated the New York audience, and no one else, I mean, WWRL, to a lesser extent, also was involved, and then KISS came along. But we were the reporter advocates, and we basically set the template for advocacy journalism, you know, that suddenly found its way across the country. Anything that was going on in New York eventually went coast to coast. And the deal is, you know, and I have, again, give David Lampel, the guy who was general manager and who I succeeded as news director at the station, to come up with this concept, and the late Percy Sutton, because Sutton was highly displeased with the way he was getting covered politically when he was as a borough president trying to run for mayor, prior to that as an assembly person and all, and he knew the value of the press. He figured that he brought enough to the table to have become New York's first black mayor, but it wasn't happening because, you know, the press did not cover him the way they would cover an Ed Koch or a Beam or even Mario Cuomo back then.
Let me jump in here real quick, Wayne, just for a point of historical clarification. So is Percy Sutton, is he Manhattan Borough president before he starts inner city broadcasting? Does he start in city broadcasting after his political career, or because of what you're talking
about?
He started
inner city broadcasting before he left office. What he did, he was borough president in the 1970s, and he, in 77, I believe, or 76, I forgot, one of those 2 years, he wanted to run for mayor. He figured he had the support of all the different political and ethnic enclaves in New York to pull it off. And at that point, A. Beam was on his way out. I think he had served all the terms that he could serve. And it was Sutton, Koch, Cuomo, and I want to say Herman Badillo, because there was always somebody there to divide the vote. But the problem was that Sutton was highly incensed that he was not getting a fair press at places where he thought he would. The Times, the Daily News, forget about the Post, you know. But and he said that what he was going to do in 1980 was cultivate a format in which people of color could politically empower themselves by having a vessel in which to communicate the issues about
right.
the community and what was going on that day. And I believe he's dead now, Roger Ailes, but I believe they co-opted that format, saw the success of what we did, because all during that time, the mother, if she was here, she would attest to it, the little black book, the fact that we were all under scrutiny by the police department, you know, there were all sorts of stories that were going on. The Dinkins rise to becoming mayor and
right.
Jesse Jackson.
Right. I don't want to get too sidetracked into history. I don't want to deal with what we're talking about right now today. But just
right.
Just really quickly. So when does he buy? Just because my own curiosity, just I want to wrap this up with this little bit about Percy Sutton. BLS is a. It came to fruition because he started Initiative Broadcasting. Is that correct? Or was
yeah.
BLS already?
I mean, there was,
already...
No, it was an LIBFM, then became BLS later. And but
he was the ownership.
WLIB
he was the ownership
was
entity
powerhouse.
Behind it. He was the ownership
yeah,
entity behind
was,
it. Is my question?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
He was the pivotal force. Right. The
I
family.
See. Now,
yeah.
I mean, I know back then, and Byron, were you in D.C. at that time? Because I know various parts across the country, they did have black, we did have black talk on other stations. I know, who was it that?
I was
James
in Atlanta,
Brown.
Georgia. Yeah, I was
and
in Atlanta,
was,
Georgia. So we had, let's see, what's her, Jill's spot? Jill, oh my gosh, a personal friend of mine whose father was the Southern DJ talk show person, you know, talk show with, we had, of course, in Atlanta, Georgia, you had CLK, which is the Clark radio station, a lot of stuff would emanate out of there. But then the answer to Petey Green, we had Allie Pat in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm.
Now, Allie Pat and Hosea Williams did your talk shows from the black perspective, which gave
right.
Allie Pat and Jose was Martin's Castro, as he called it. And in Atlanta, Georgia, Jose Williams was raising all kind, as he was known, is the boy
right.
in the China closet. Okay? And so in Atlanta, talk radio, with especially there, and then, of course, in Augusta, GA, we already know James Brown ran his thing. And then in Southern, the other Southern DJs and radio stations, privately owned, kept the civil rights movement alive. If it wasn't
exactly.
the white press, it was the
right,
black media that kept the civil rights movement alive.
Exactly, and that's the point I'm getting to in terms of the network, small as it was, of many
yes.
of our people that in the various different locales had some sort of communication to get the word out, get the information out to the community, what was going on. And it was really the precursor, obviously, to social media now, when we're talking about making the moves and knowing what's going on in the community. I want to disagree with a point you made, Wayne, about these kids now are doing, they're not having it, as opposed to what we were doing in the 60s, because each generation, they did their job to a certain degree. Whether you could talk greater or to a lesser degree, I don't know whether it could be measured probably with the civil rights generation, but then you look at the Jim Crow generation or the right out of slavery generation. And so when the complaint comes back to these young kids, like their complaint is, I need something more than someone died for my right to vote. Well, no, you don't, because someone did die for your right to vote. And each generation has to do their part to move the mantle forward. Now, it's slow. 400 years is a slow progression. I realized in my thinking, thinking about it earlier, when I first realized that this thing of racism and slavery that follows us as black people in this country, when I realized that it was a thing as a kid, and I thought, okay, well, maybe it will be older, obviously because of the involvement of my family, certain things I was aware of more, a lot sooner than other kids my age and stuff like that. But at this point in my life, I realized as a young man, I didn't want to spend my whole life having to deal with oppression and racism. And when you get a little older, at least for me, what I've recently realized is that it's part of the struggle that we were born into. And each generation needs to do their part to push that struggle forward. And you rebel harder when you're younger, because you're not down for this to affect you for the rest of your life. You know what I mean? And so at this point in my life, I understood that our job, my generation's job, was to get out there and vote as much as possible, was to pick up the mantle and carry it as much as possible. We delivered the first, in our generation, as the first African-American president who was our age, who was predicted by Bobby Kennedy 40 years ago. So, you know, I think it does us to a certain degree a disservice when we talk about what did the previous generations do, as if they didn't do anything. Because when people now, if I think that I have it bad, then I just have to ask or listen to my father's stories about his life. And if someone in the next generation thinks they have it bad, then, or that might come after me, then I tell them, well, at least you could turn on the TV and it not be a surprise or a shock to see black people on TV, right? At least we know about people getting stopped and beat up and murdered. Before, we didn't know when I was a kid. So each generation coming along, they can say that as they look, because the struggle is so long and has been so hard, and who wants to deal with that? Like someone recently said, it's exhausting being black. But it's exhausting being the chosen people, too, I suppose. I mean, I just wanted to throw that out. You're going to say Wayne.
Basically, quickly just give clarity what I meant. You know, is that you're right. I'm not saying that what we did in the past did not get us to where we are now. But
I'm not saying it for a defending kind of thing. I'm just saying the props have to be given there. I'm not saying it to try to clarify or correct you or take issue with what you said. I'm saying my point merely is that when I hear the young people saying that, I want them to realize that they did their thing, those previous generations.
Yeah.
Don't take away. Don't act like they didn't do their work, because that's what I said. If you don't think it's any different, if you don't think anything's changed, ask your grandma, ask your auntie if anything's changed. You know, if you live in the north, go down south, see your southern relatives. You see what's changed.
Well,
you know, so I just don't like the fact, you know, I wanted to defend what you guys did in the 60s, you know, and make sure people don't dishonor that contribution, you know.
No, I appreciate that, and I remember getting my head beaten in 68, 60, right after Martin Luther King was killed on Fulton Street. We had riots then, you know. I think we have got, I'm glad to hear that there's more talk about defending what communities that have developed as a result of the anger and pain that we suffered 30 years ago instead of destroying our own. You know, I understand why some people will be involved in the pillaging of certain commercial establishments, but these establishments sometimes are owned by our own, you know, and it's not like as if it's easy. You know, I give credit to anybody who could be self-sufficient and taking advantage of empowerment programs that this man is looking to take away from us. You know, but I think I really feel, and I'm glad that some of the broadcasters are pointing this out, that there is a clear distinction between those who are silently or quietly protesting than the provocateurs out there who come in many stripes and different colors.
Well,
that's probably what they're saying.
And these guys, the one thing that they have gotten more savvy in understanding, like you said, about destroying goods and services that supply and support their community, but they've also now, through the social media and new technology, have understood that these provocateurs that are coming in, you know, everybody's, the one thing I will say about these generations is that they're a lot more sophisticated in terms of the political play and the societal play that's going on. The COINTEL forces, you know, like you said, the provocateurs or people that have been found out to might have been white supremacists blending in with the crowd or other type of individuals blending in with the crowd to start violent actions to make the police then have to react. You know, so it was great that a lot of people started peeping that game and started defending these places. A lot of people, like you said, that were the real peaceful protesters because they understood. They learned from the last, you know, couple of riots that those communities didn't come back. Or it took a long time for the communities to rebound. You know, one which I'm from, you guys are from, Byron's from as well. You know, so, I mean, in all of the major black cities, we've all gone through that. And this generation has learned, like, let's not burn up our own stuff. And they've learned who is doing that. And that's the one, hopefully,
I think the silver lining in the cloud, because right now we see the dark cloud, but there is a silver lining in this. We ask and we've been praying for change. Change is about disruption. Change happens as a result of status quo and realizing that they can grasp the power. That's carpe diem. They're seizing the moment. So this millennial generation has finally learned what their purpose is. It's given, and it started not just with this, but remember that cover of Time magazine, after the kids got killed down there in the school in Florida, they got together. Enough is enough. This is a generational move that's ongoing as we speak. And now that they have the gun issue, they've got the race issue, they found their mark and their purpose. And if you look across the country, these protests will ultimately die out. But right now, the people in front of the National Guard and the police are a lot more white people than black people sometimes. Okay? And you have to recognize, and this happened in D.C. yesterday when all this was going on with the president on Monday with his photo op opportunity. What happened was everybody knew the you had to be off the curfew at 7 p.m. The curfew was at 7 p.m. Well, guess what? At 6:55, 6:59, the frontline black folks who had gotten the word, this is where you go, the drum speaks louder than the radio and the word, because somebody got the word that they were about to move on those protesters, and the black folks all, almost to the person, moved away from that front line.
You said the black folks did?
The black folks did, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which says to me that because and here's something else. Jose Williams' daughter in Atlanta, Georgia, Elizabeth Williams Omalami, her husband is a famous Omalami, and y'all probably work together, Eric.
Her husband is who?
Both a famous Omalami. He did work on movies.
I hired him to be in our film Drop Squad, a famous good brother, good actor, and his
good
wife
brother.
Too.
Well, that's right. He's Hosea's daughter's husband, and they run the Hosea Feed the Hungry. Well, guess what she's doing in increments of like 5 or 10 minutes, at the most 10-minute pieces daily? She's on the social media saying to folks, look, I'm the daughter of a civil rights icon. I marched as a young person. I'm going to give you instructions on what you need to know so that when the next time you go to that protest, you need to make sure you're properly attired, got your equipment with you, because if you need a mask or whatever, you know you're going down there, be willing to know that if you're going to get arrested, make sure your bond is covered. See, that's what people don't know about the civil rights movement. Those marches were covered with protocol. Martin
extraordinary.
Luther King.
Well, there was a real strategy. There was a real kind of,
that's
well, not to say there's not a strategy
that's
here.
Right.
But if you look at Eyes of the Prize,
and
you could watch it any documentary, Eyes of the Prize or anything like
that.
You could see them going through training. I just want to jump in here and say, I didn't know that a what's her first name?
Afemu and Elizabeth Williams Omalami.
Elizabeth Williams, but she goes by a different name, right? He's Afemu and
she goes by
an African.
Yeah, she goes by Elizabeth Omalami. I was in their wedding.
right. So both of her, they came into audition for Drop Squad. This is more of the very few degrees of separation between actors. They came
because we
shot Drop Squad in Atlanta. They came in to audition, very good. You know, I was doing the kind of, obviously looking at the actors and choosing which ones to at least bring in for the producers and directors. So, of course, Afemu and Elizabeth came in, of course, and brought them in. But also, at the time, I didn't know that she was Hosea, his daughter. I wish I had known. But also, we had Bernice King.
Bernice, God bless her. And
Who's the reverend? So one was reverend, and there's another one.
Bernice is the current one who's a minister. And
she was a minister. So the other
actress.
The other sister, right. The one that's the actress, she also came and auditioned for it. So it's just a little ironic thing. We were shooting in Atlanta, obviously, and they were both actresses.
Yes.
So they came in and auditioned. It was a nice little thing. Unfortunately, they were auditioning for the same role. So Elizabeth got the role, and What's-Her-Face didn't.
Georgia Film Commission at that time.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's how close. We've been circling.
So you know Al Cooper.
Al Cooper and Bill Nunn. Everybody used to say Al was my brother because we looked so much alike.
I was just getting ready to say you guys could be twins there.
That's right. And they had, of course, they were a comic team. There was Al and Bill. They had a comic.
Yeah, I remember they had a little act.
They said comedy.
That's what you told me.
That's right. This is the thing but we are seeing our generations coming together. And that's interesting because we now are seeing that this movement is not just us. This movement is about democracy right now. Democracy is in trouble. It's in serious trouble right now. And the world is watching and they're seeing it unfold and come in their very eyes. And believe me, the news breaks come so often in this city, it's almost like it's a regular program.
Mm-hmm. Same here. Now, I almost wonder, you know, the whole democracy in the United States, you know, if we paid any attention to the historical relevance of a movie like Gangs of New York, right?
Yeah.
Which kind of opened my eyes to really the kind of the rampant kind of graft in the beginnings of this country, the developing of America as it was coming into being America, and how it was just like the wild, you know, you see movies about the Wild West, but the whole country was wild like that, and when there were power grabs and grabs for dominance, not only whole ethnic groups of one over the other, but certainly of individuals over other individuals, and obviously the best way you can tell who's not in your group is the people with the other skin color, the other team. But it's just interesting that, and I guess my point is, I don't really know whether the story of America seems like it's just that, a story, for them to put out there to abuse this system by a certain few individuals. Like the original, and we only got about 5 minutes left, so I don't want to get too deep in it, but the original signers of the Declaration of Independence, they all were white men who were property owners, right? So that means they left out white people who weren't property owners. They left out women. Of course, they left out a whole race of people, and obviously Native Americans and any other colored person that was here. So, but they wrote this document that was, you know, everybody's equal and, you know, it reads great. It's one of the greatest humanitarian documents in the world or whatever it is, whatever all these praises people try to fall on. But behind that is all of this craziness going on, you know, this brutality, this corruption, all of these things going on. So I don't know if they ever really meant it to be really a democracy. Maybe they were just playing. It's like I keep saying about the first Rocky movie when they said about Rocky. one of Apollo Creed's guys told him, his corner man told him, my man, I forget the actor's name, but he told him. He said, he don't know it's a show. He thinks it's a fight.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
meaning that, you know, they told Rocky it was supposed to be a show, but he's trying to win the fight. You know, so I don't,
well, one of the
you
things,
know.
One of the things that this country, and I'll say this quickly, has got to come to grips with, of its 244 years of existence since 1776, 244 years in existence, 242 of those years, this country has been in a war. Mm. Think about that. You cannot design a pathway to peace and democracy if you're the bully in the room 242 times out of 244 years, and in which one of them, the biggest conflict, killed 750,000 people, and that's the Civil War. We
that's
have
right.
to come to grips with that, and this is what's blocking us from becoming a true democracy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, plus the racism aspect, you know, that they want. That's what I'm saying. Maybe they don't want it. Maybe they didn't want it to be a democracy. Maybe they just wanted it to be a democracy for white people, and not even be a democracy for all white people, but just be kind of the facade of a democracy. So I don't know. I mean, but now obviously they're stuck with it, and they got to live up to. You know, since they've been playing it so long, and each crew has been coming along and playing it so long, they clearly have to live up to the facade to a certain degree, I would suppose. But, I mean, just like that needs to be overrun, and we really didn't get into the notion that you brought up, Wayne. It was like, we need to revamp policing. You know, that's what they're talking about, an entire different approach to the police force and policing and what it means. Because,
yeah.
you know, it was,
and,
part of its development came about controlling black people. So we got about 3 minutes.
Exactly, and I mean that was at the core in the beginning, and the deal is that even though the nation evolved and they said one thing, but they never necessarily did that, and there are people who are hired to do this particular job. I'm not saying it's an easy job, and some of these people have been exposed to the military. I sometimes see some of these retired Marines who have joined local police departments. I equate some of the training that has been done to become a Marine, which is probably the most advanced military training compared to the Navy, the Air Force, and everything else, and the Army. And I look at some of these wild, uncontrollable types in the police department. I'm just saying, I wonder, you know, where they got this background. I mean, what gives you a right during a peaceful protest to throw an innocent woman up against the curb with your commander right next to you? I mean, where does that come from? You know? And again, it's about the culture of the department. It doesn't matter, you know, what you look like. It's the way, and there's no uniformity in the law. That's the other thing that really pisses me off, if I may say so.
Right.
You know,
all
you
right.
can leave New York, go somewhere else, and it's the same old thing.
There it is. Well, Wayne, you get the last word, Wayne Gilman. There it is, my brother. Want to give a quick shout out to Steve King, Congressman from Iowa, wherever
See
he lost.
Bye-bye.
We want to say congratulations to the sister that became mayor in Ferguson.
Yeah.
Right on with it.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
right
gentlemen.
On,
give
right
you give you send off. So Wayne, go ahead first. Tell the people how you feel about them.
I just want to say keep hope alive and keep the struggle moving. And I also want to give a shout out to Yvette Clark, our Congressmember here in New York.
There you go. There you go. Brother Wayne Gim, we'll talk to you again next week or maybe Saturday. Who knows? Brother Byron, tell the people how you feel.
Byron's here. Peace and love always. And remember, if you're not part of the solution, you can guarantee you're the problem. But you can make that change. Vote.
Right on, brother. We'll talk to you again. Brother Byron Saunders. All right. It's been K Son and Friends, formerly K Thompson Live. I'm Citizen Payne. Those are my boys, Wayne Gilman, legendary newsman, Byron Saunders, legendary historian. We're doing it again. Want to thank you. You can always hear us every Wednesday, usually live, 8 to 9 p.m. We're archived. And sometimes we do that Saturday thing with all the brothers letting loose. We'll talk to you later. Keep Hope Alive. The struggle continues. Power to the people.
I'm never a fugitive on the run. Brother, brother, life needs begun to be another one. Tell the enemy serving time to choose the line, y'all. The critics stop me from crying. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man and I can never be a veteran. All the script of situations unreal. I got a raw deal. So I'm looking for the steal. Word them up. I'm looking for that steal. Don't you know, they got me rotten in the time that I'm serving. Telling you what happened to faith, I'm there sowing.
13, my son, my child, is, my child, is that I'm